Second chapter, I'll be reading the entire chapter. Ruth chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. This is the word of the Lord. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she's continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." And Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread. Dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also, pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." And Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. And she lived with her mother-in-law. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Thank you to Joshua and our musicians for leading us already. Those songs tied in so well with the theme and the mood of this chapter. The Lord who provides and shelters under his wings. I want to tell you an illustration as we begin, courtesy of Dale Ralph Davis. Up until one surprising day on the golf course, Stephen Lungu's life had been filled with suffering and sadness. Born to a 14-year-old mother in former Rhodesia, the country that's now Zimbabwe, Stephen remembers his father arguing with his mother because his father doubted his paternity of young Stephen. Some of his earliest memories are feeling personally responsible for his parents' own marital difficulties. And from there, his suffering would only increase. One day, his mother dropped off Stephen and his two younger siblings at a market, told them to wait on her, and then never came back. She had abandoned her children, leaving them effectively orphaned and facing life on their own. To make matters worse, no relative wanted Stephen. One aunt did allow him to live in her chicken coop, using a burlap bag for his blanket. Some kindness, some aunt. At 11, he ran away from this life, probably to no one's great concern. He fed himself on the garbage left outside of well-to-do homes, acquiring the unenviable skill of figuring out what old, half-eaten foods wouldn't make him vomit. One day, he was hanging around some older boys at a golf club when a man approached him, asking if Stephen wanted to be his caddy for the day, that is, to carry the man's golf clubs during his round. Immediately, Stephen agreed, realizing the earning potential of this, and regretting only, as he later recalled, the large rip in his shirt that made him seem so out of place at a nice establishment. The man took Stephen to his golf clubs, and Stephen, eager to earn the money, grabbed the man's bag strap and pulled. But the bag didn't budge. So Stephen tried again, much harder this time, pulling and pulling until his little eyes were bugging out nearly from his head. Still nothing. The clubs wouldn't move. They were far too heavy for him. He tried next, dragging the bag behind him, but made it only a few paces when he dropped the bag on his toe and howled in pain. The man heard the noise and turned around and came back now, aware that his golf clubs had not been following him, and found poor Stephen ready to burst into tears. And then, as Stephen later described it, kindness rained down on me. "Oh, dear boy," the man said, "have I packed too many golf clubs for you? Never mind. You're a brave lad for trying, and soon you'll be big enough. And here, have some change anyway." And with that, the man dropped silver coins into Stephen's hand, a fortune in the eyes of the poor street child. "My eyes blurred as tears of relief filled them," Stephen later wrote. "I thought he was wonderful." Sometimes kindness just overwhelms you. Just overwhelms you. So it was for Ruth the Moabitess in our text today. She has returned with her mother-in-law Naomi back to Naomi's native Israel, carrying with her each step of the way the heavy weight of her grief. Naomi's husband and two sons have died, one of them Ruth's own husband. And though Naomi has given Ruth every reason to remain in Moab and remarry and restart a life there, Ruth hasn't done so. She's pledged herself in life and death to Naomi to seek her good, to show her kindness, just the same sort that God himself shows. What's more, Ruth has also pledged herself to Naomi's God. She is joining Israel come what may, renouncing her life that she once lived in Moab, the gods of that land, for the Lord as her God and him alone. But these two women are limping, as it were, back to Bethlehem. Returning in desperate poverty, the kind that would make their eyes blur with tears to receive only the slightest token of generosity. Any help for them would be so deeply appreciated. Any food would be welcome, any port in this storm. And what a port that the Lord has for them today in our text. The port of loyal love, of covenant kindness, great enough to make even the bitter Naomi acknowledge it in wonder. That's our main idea today, loyal kindness on display. And as we'll see, and I hope you will, that kindness in our text today is both human and divine. Or perhaps more accurately, we would say, divine kindness expressed through humans. It is beautiful, it is moving to behold. And church, with just a little effort, we might spot it in our own lives as well. We might behold God's kindness to us. So may the Lord give us eyes to see the loyal kindness that has never left us when we take shelter under Yahweh's wings. Now, a word about how the chapter appears to be organized. I think this is correct. It might help you to think about the analogy of a picture that hangs on your wall that includes the frame, and then within that, the matting, and then central of all, the picture itself that you look at. The frame here on either end of this is two sections of dialogue in which Ruth and Naomi talk. The first one's in verses 1 through 3, the last one verses 18 through 23. The matting, so to speak, is the sections that come after that, those in which Boaz talks with his workers, verses 4 through 7, and then verses 15 through 16. And then at the center, highlighted, the thing the narrator most wants you to see and most wants to draw your attention to is the portrait of Boaz's conversation with Ruth, where they talk in verses 8 through 14. So I'm going to follow that outline. It's not the greatest for organizing preaching points. We'll spend more time on some parts and less on others. But I think that will at least highlight for you the importance of verses 8 through 14. All right, let's begin now with our first section, verses 1 through 3. And I just want to reread those verses again. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go into the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Okay, a little bit of background that you're going to need to make sense of what's going on here. In God's law, and I'm thinking specifically of Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy 24, God had commanded Israel, when its farmers were harvesting, not to reap their field right up to its edges, not to make a second pass over it to extract every last bit of the harvest, and not even to go back into the field if they forgot, say, a bundle of cut grain stalks lying there. Why, you might ask? Isn't that the formula for bad business? Isn't that inefficient? Well, what it was from God's perspective was good generosity. Here is Deuteronomy 24 giving the rationale. It says it, and it refers there to the uncollected harvest, it shall be for the sojourner, for the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. So follow that rationale there. In other words, Israel was to remember what it was like to be a landless people, to be a downtrodden people, to be a suffering people, which surely the foreigners and orphans and widows in their midst would have been. And they were to show the kindness toward those groups that they would have liked to have been shown themselves. In other words, they were not to imitate Pharaoh's own cruelty, but Yahweh's own kindness as children coming to bear a family resemblance to their God. And so in the genius of God's arrangement here, a little of the harvest was to be left over for the poor, who would themselves obtain it through the satisfaction of a good day's work. And in that way, everyone would have enough, a really beautiful economy. Ruth, for her part, is determined she'll get in on this opportunity. And I just want you to notice her virtue here in verse 2. In verse 2, she shows initiative. She clearly has a sound plan of action. She says she'll go into the field and glean after the reapers. She also shows continued kindness, sacrificial kindness to Naomi, who apparently was unable to go and gather for herself. So Ruth is proposing here to go and be Naomi's provider, that she'll feed Naomi from the sweat of her own brow. But notice even here that Ruth is proposing and not merely insisting, and in this she shows deference to the older Naomi, asking for permission to go, respectfulness to Naomi's wishes. Not only does Ruth show initiative and kindness and deference, I think we should also note that she is taking a risk to her safety in going. It would have been dangerous in that day for a young, unattended, widowed foreign woman to go work out in the fields among the men. After all, she had no men of her clan to protect her there. And this was the time of the judges in which every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so Ruth is taking a risk. And yet, brave Ruth goes into potential danger, out of love for Naomi, fending off the hunger of two through the industry of one. Now, there are perhaps some gender stereotypes in our day that the book of Ruth helpfully pushes back on. Sometimes we tend to think that the women among God's people are to be always demure, unassertive, passive, wallflowerish. But try as you might, Ruth doesn't fit that mold. No, our sister here is a go-getter, a plan maker, a risk taker. She's bold, she's brave, she is assertive, she's heroic. And yet she mingles all of this with the greatest respect to her elders. In so many ways, the lady we have in front of us has got it figured out from a character standpoint. And so let's be sure that in our ideal feminine portrait, we've got room for the Ruths of the kingdom. In fact, perhaps Ruth would make a good starting point when we think about what that portrait should look like in the first place. On a practical level, men, encourage your wife when she has plans, when she takes initiative, when she shows bravery. All of that is fully compatible with male headship in the home and in the church. And it also blesses the world with the contributions of the Ruths. And it blesses the Ruths of the world with the chance to contribute to it. We need Ruths, so let's encourage them and never stifle them. One more point before we move on, and here's one I want to spend a little time on. I think this is an important one. Notice God's subtle providence in these verses. Notice his subtle providence. In verse 1, we meet Boaz, who is called a relative of her husband's, a worthy man, or maybe your translation says a man of great wealth, of the clan of Elimelech. So he is clearly a relative of the late Elimelech, that is Naomi's husband. And that might mean, we would be reasonable to infer, that he'll also have a certain compassion for Ruth and Naomi as relatives. He, probably better than anyone, would be open to Ruth's gleaning in his field. And then there's this other thing that the narrator calls him, what our translations variously call a worthy man or a man of great wealth or something to that effect. The Hebrew word here refers most basically to someone of strength, but that strength, depending on the context, might be strength of resources, that is, those possessed by a wealthy man, or strength of character, that is, possessed by a virtuous person. The closest word we might have in our English language for this range of meaning is the word noble, at least if we assume that wealth comes with high rank. But now, given how exquisitely crafted this story is, and given how Boaz, as we'll see, actually fits both of these senses, strength of resources and strength of character, my guess is that the author actually intends both senses here. It intends that this will dawn on us as the chapter progresses, that he is strong in both of these ways. Boaz is both a man of means who is able to help Ruth and Naomi, but he's also a man of character who will be willing to help her. He's exactly the guy you want to run into. Probably more than any other human being living at this time on the face of the earth, he's the one Ruth needs to meet. And wonder of wonders, as verse 3 shows us, that's just what she did. She goes out to glean, and, to quote the verse, she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. She happened to. Literally in the Hebrew, and the author's saying this even more pointedly, her chance chanced. It just so happened to work out this way. Now, there are two directions interpretively that we could go with this. Direction number one, man, Ruth got really lucky. What a coincidence to have met Boaz. Boy, she needs to go play the Bethlehem lottery on her way home. Her luck's so good today. Or direction two, which is to see the narrator as making a tongue-in-cheek statement here, one that invites us as the readers to reflect on exactly why these two happened to meet. Count me firmly in the latter camp, especially when you consider how the author already in this story has attributed the events that occur on the world stage to God's hand, such as chapter 1, verse 6, the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So did the barley harvest just happen to occur? No, says the narrator, the Lord gave his people food. Did Ruth just happen to come into Boaz's field of all fields? No, the Lord directed her steps. So I think the narrator's words here, she happened to come, her chance chanced, are said with a little bit of a wink and a wry smile, the kind that encourages us to acknowledge that it was the Lord who was directing these things all along. Davis tells the story of a tavern keeper's wife in 19th century Nottingham, England, who was dying, and a certain evangelist was asked to go and visit her, and when he did, he found her in a great spiritual condition, rejoicing in Christ as her Savior, eager to greet him. The evangelist asked, "How was it, ma'am, that you came to know the Lord?" And in reply, she handed him a little torn, folded piece of paper and said it was by reading that. It was a bit of an American newspaper on which was printed an extract from one of Charles Spurgeon's sermons, Spurgeon being the great London preacher. The woman had read the newspaper and come to faith. And when he asked how she got the newspaper, it turned out that it had been wrapped around a parcel that was sent to her in England from Australia. Now, think with me about that chain of events. Spurgeon preaches a sermon in London. The transcript of that sermon just so happens to be sent to the U.S., where it's printed in a newspaper. That newspaper just so happens to have made its way to Australia, and the person wrapping the parcel in Australia just so happens to have used the portion with the sermon in his mailing to the woman in England, and she just so happens to have read part of that packing paper and believed. A lot of just so happens there, aren't there? Was it that her chance chanced to receive that paper, or was it something different? The all-controlling wise hand of God behind every step of the way. I wonder in your own life if you can see those subtle providences of God at work, the ways he's been working for your good in an understated way. You might say at this point that you can't well trace those, therefore that you don't have those. Somehow you're exempt. And if that's your position on the matter, I'd simply like to encourage you with a smile to remember that subtle providences are by definition subtle. We must, as Davis says, exegete our circumstances a bit. We must scour them to see where God has been at work, looking through the eyes of faith. In some cases, it might help us to enlist the help of others who can see a bit clearer, more clearly, what God has been doing in our lives. And still others, it might just be wise to give our story time to unfold. Nevertheless, I have a thought experiment for you, thinking not only about your entire life, but even more pointedly about the year 2020. 2020 was probably no one's favorite year. It was not mine. But in what ways, I wonder, did you see the Lord's subtle providences in your life, his understated ways of working for your good? What just so happens occurred that you need to give him thanks for? It might actually be some good medicine for our souls to detect the ways that God was up to our good, even in the midst of our pain. I don't know all the details of your 2020, but I do know this. Your chance didn't chance in what happened to you. And if you're in Christ, God was working for your good in all things, even in ways you didn't perceive, even through subtle providences. Well, let's keep this thing moving. We could talk about subtle providences, I think, all day, but let's look next, and this time much more briefly, at the second section, verses 4 through 7, where we see Boaz talking with his workers. First words in the Bible are often important, just as a reading tip. First words are often important, and Boaz's first words here clearly reflect his godliness, right? They paint him as a godly man. "The Lord be with you," he says in greeting to his workers, and then they respond in kind, "The Lord bless you." Can we just stop and notice for a moment a healthy work environment before our very eyes? Boaz has not only learned how to integrate faith and work, he's also apparently a boss who cares deeply about the well-being of his workers and who has earned their respect in return. More of that in this world, please. More of that. So our hopes are confirmed that Boaz is both wealthy as a landowner and righteous. And now we have not one but two godly characters in this chapter, both Boaz and Ruth. They really should meet sometime, shouldn't they? And lo and behold, in verse 5, as if we're warming to that idea, Boaz asks about Ruth. Whose young woman is this? I'm not necessarily sure that we should understand this romantically right off the bat. I think as an observant boss, he notices a new face in his workforce. He can't quite place her in his mind. He probably wants to know where she fits into society. Whose daughter or wife is this? To which tribe or clan does she belong? Where should I place her and identify her? And his foreman says, well, she's the young Moabite woman who has recently come back with Naomi. And she asked this very morning to be able to glean behind our reapers. In fact, the woman is so industrious that she's hardly stopped working all day. She's been hard at work. And then that leads to the meeting in our third section. This is the central section in the chapter, verses 8 through 14, where Boaz and Ruth finally do meet. Notice in the chapter 2, in this section, all of the kindnesses that rain down on Ruth that come from Boaz. First, he tells her in verse 8 not to even worry about going to another field. He'll provide for her in his field alone. His generosity will not run dry. It's a huge gift then for Ruth to know where food will come from every day, to be able to show up in the same spot, to devote all of her energy simply to working and none to having to figure out where to work. That's a gift. Second, in verse 9, he tells her that he's already charged the young men not to touch her. He has instituted what we might call today an anti-sexual harassment policy in the workplace. And this relieves our very legitimate concern about Ruth's safety. She's going to be safe under Boaz's watch. Third, and also in verse 9, Boaz will provide her with water while she works. In those days, foreigners might well have been expected to have drawn water for Israelites, and women certainly would have been for men. But notice how Boaz reverses this, tells Ruth to drink from what his young men have drawn. It's a shocking amount of honor shown to her here, given her position in society. But as we'll see in just a moment, Boaz is clearly honoring Ruth's godliness. Her position is in the social hierarchy is of no concern to him. Honoring her godliness is. Fourth, skipping down to verse 14, he feeds her a meal, so much so that she has leftovers. And of all the things in Ruth's plan that day, that were in her plan, leftovers were surely not one of them. Leftovers would have made her kind of, you know, reach and clean out her ear. Did I hear you right? Leftovers? Yes, leftovers. God is so good. And then fifth, and now I guess I'll just incorporate the fourth section in verses 15 and 16, fold that in here. Boaz orders his men to let Ruth glean among the sheaves, that is the bundled cut stalks, and to pull out, in fact, some of the stalks for her to glean, all without insulting her dignity or scolding her. She won't even have to cut stalks now. The work will be considerably easier, and the result is that Ruth ends up with a haul in verse 17, about an ephah of barley's worth. About an ephah of barley. If we were to describe this according to our measurements today, it would be somewhere between 30 and 50 pounds. About the size of one really enormous bag of dog food, or maybe two. That's a lot. Ruth was going to have to put her back into it just to haul it all home that day. And Boaz, in case you haven't figured this, is going above and beyond the requirements of God's law. But perhaps we would be better to say that Boaz has truly grasped the heart of the law. That is generosity toward the poor, because God has been generous to us. Extravagant kindness, because that's exactly what we have received. And when Ruth, in verse 10, can't understand why Boaz would even take notice of her, since I am a foreigner, she says, his answer in verses 11 and 12 forms the theological center of the chapter. Verse 11, but Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Now notice here two things that Boaz clearly believes about the Lord, the God of Israel. First, he believes that he is a rewarder of righteousness. A rewarder of righteousness. Such as Ruth's choice to sacrifice everything for Naomi. And friends, I think this is a game changer for us as well. We are freed up to show unexpected, breathtaking generosity and to make enormous, jaw-dropping sacrifices for others because we have a God who sees and a God who rewards, who gives full reward, in fact, maybe in this life, without fail in the life to come. Second, notice something else Boaz believes about God. He believes that God provides refuge for all who seek it in him. God is not only a rewarder of righteousness, he provides refuge for all who seek it in him, including even Moabites. Even Moabites. The imagery here of God's wings is so evocative. It pictures God as, ready for this? A mother bird. A mother bird offering her wings to protect her weak and defenseless young. Ruth has chosen the Lord as her God, and Boaz is convinced that he will treat her in this way, that he'll receive her in her weakness, that he'll cover her with his wings, that he'll draw her in close. He will, as the hymn says, shelter her under his wings, yea, so gently sustain her. In fact, as Boaz does this very thing for Ruth, he's really the means through which God himself does it. God's wings, we might say, are attached to Boaz's torso in this chapter. And as is so often the case, God cares for others through the care of his tenderhearted people. That's how it's expressed. Notice as well, you have to love this point, that Ruth's national origin is no turnoff to this God. The chapter keeps calling her Ruth the Moabite over and over. You probably spotted that. Moabite, Moabite. But perhaps that's as if to say, saying it as it comes here in this chapter, that God is not ashamed in the least of that designation. He sees her principally as Ruth his daughter, as Ruth his treasured one, as Ruth who shelters beneath his wings.